Hello everyone, my name is Jacob Menig. I'm the host of the Behavioral Health Integration Podcast. Today we have a very special guest, Terry Tucker. Terry has been a NCAA Division I basketball player. Terry was also a police officer and an undercover narcotics agent, as well as a SWAT team negotiator. Terry is a motivational speaker, as well as an author of the book, 10 Principles to Leading Your Uncommon and Extraordinary Life. Again, Terry, thank you so much for being on my podcast, man. I really appreciate it.
Well, Jacob, thanks for having me. I'm really looking forward to talking with you.
I mean, I am very excited because just reading your introduction and your bio, you're obviously a very interesting person. You have a fascinating story, and I cannot wait to dive into it. But if you would like, would you like to give my listeners a little background on you and how your career started? And
sure. I was born and raised on the south side of Chicago. You can't tell this from looking at me, but or from my voice, but I'm 6'8" tall, mm-hmm. and I played college basketball at the Citadel, which is a military college in Charleston, South Carolina. I have a brother who's 6'7", who was a pitcher for the University of Notre Dame, another brother who's 6'6", who was drafted by the Cleveland Cavaliers wow. and the National Basketball Association. And then my dad was 6'5". So I sort of joke that if you sat behind our family in church growing up, there wasn't a prayer's chance yep. you were going to see anything that was going on.
And the genes.
Yeah. But our 5'8" mother was the boss. You know, it didn't matter how big, tall, strong we were. Yep. Whatever mom said, that's the way it went. Oh, yeah. So I graduated from the Citadel. I moved home to find a job. I was the first person in my family to actually graduate from college. And I was all set to make my mark on the world, you know, with my newly obtained business administration degree.
Little side note now, you being a tall guy, you're good at basketball. I'm sure you probably had other offers, right? Was there a reason why you chose Citadel to go to school or?
I did. I actually had committed to play in the Mid-American Conference at the okay. University of Toledo because it was close to Chicago. You know, I mean, I wanted to be able to have my family and my girlfriend and all that come and see me. I was offered a scholarship. I had verbally committed. This was before you could sign, you know, the date before you could sign a national letter of intent. And a couple weeks before I had that letter of intent signing, Toledo called me up and said, "Hey, we're not sure we have a scholarship. We'll get back to you."
Oh.
And so I was like, "Oh, okay." And then a week later, they did. They came back and they said, "Hey, we have a scholarship for you." And you know, I was a kid. I didn't understand what any of this meant. And my dad was like, "Well, what do you think that means?" I'm like, I don't know. I guess he's like, you know, and he kind of laid it out for me. You know, he said they probably found somebody they wanted better. You know, that person ended up saying no. Now they're coming back to you. And then he asked the million-dollar question. Do you want to play for somebody who doesn't have the integrity, you know, that they offer you something, they don't stand behind it, and then they come back and offer you again? And I'm like, I don't know. I didn't really understand integrity and, you know, when I was 17 years old and stuff. So I thought about it for a while and I'm like, no, I don't want to play for it. And I was so lucky. I think, you know, kind of God works in mysterious ways. I ended up playing for Les Robinson, who most people don't know his name. He ended up taking over for Jim Valvano at North Carolina State Valvano got in trouble. And he's also the only person, as far as I know, that was a Division I basketball coach at three different schools and also the athletic director of those three schools. So it was the Citadel, East Tennessee State, and North Carolina State. So he was the athletic director and the basketball coach at all three of those schools. Not to mention, he was just a super guy and, you know, awesome. Learned a lot from him. So I was very lucky in that regard.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Hey, everything works in mysterious ways. It really does. Now, you graduated, right, with a business degree, I believe?
I did.
Okay. Now, it's funny because, like, when you usually graduate, I know in my experience, you know, when I graduated my undergrad, the teachers, I'm not saying it's their fault, but they pump your brain with ideas like, oh, you could do this, you could do great things and this and that. When you get out the real world, it's not always what it seems to be, especially from the teacher's words.
Yeah, I mean, I graduated. I mean, you're much younger than I am. I graduated in 1982, and the economy was terrible at that point in time. And so, and again, there was no, you know, there was no internet, there was no social media, there was nothing like that to help you find a job. So it was literally, you know, kind of pounding the pavement, getting out the newspaper, looking in the want ads, calling up people that you knew, and saying, you know, hey, you know, anybody who's looking and that kind. So it was much more labor intensive back then. And, you know, I just got lucky. I lucked into the job at Wendy's. They were looking for a marketing trainee. And, you know, I remember I think for the first 3 months, my most significant business accomplishment was like making copies and gassing up the company cars of the field marketing managers. I was the idiot who got to do all the jobs that nobody else wanted to do.
Yeah. Like, did you think you were going to spend the rest of your life at that job, or did you kind of have different dreams?
You know, I really, for me, it was a job. I did have other dreams, but unfortunately, when I graduated from college, I ended up living with my parents for the next 3.5 years as I helped my mom care for my father and my grandmother, who were both dying of different forms of cancer. So really, it was a job for me. I was more focused on the family dynamic that was going on at home. But my passion, my purpose, my why, whatever you want to call it, I always felt was law enforcement. And
really?
Yeah, I know. It seems kind of weird. But if you look at my resume, it'll kind of make a little bit of sense now. My grandfather, my paternal grandfather, was a Chicago police officer from 1924 to 1954. So was in Chicago during Prohibition, when alcohol was outlawed, you know, during the Great Depression, the late 20s, the early 1930s. And when the gangsters, you know, Al Capone and those guys were shooting up the city, and he was actually shot in the line of duty with his own gun. It was not a serious injury. He was shot in the ankle, taking a homicide suspect back to the lockup. And I remember when I said, you know, to my dad, look, I want to kind of go the way, you know, Papa George went. And my dad was like, oh, no. You're going to go to college. You're going to major in business. Yeah. You're going to get out, get a great job, get married, have 2.4 kids and live happily ever after. But that was what my dad wanted me to do.
Well, and I wonder, why do you think he felt that way? Because growing up with a father in law enforcement, I'm sure he's heard some things and.
Oh, heard some things.
And I could be wrong. I could be wrong, but.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, he remembers the stories my grandmother used to tell about the knock on the door when my grandfather was shot up. You know, Mrs. Tucker, grab your son. My dad was an infant at the time, but come with us. Your husband's been shot. And I mean, let's face it, trauma medicine in 1935 was a whole lot different than trauma medicine in 2022. Yeah. So yeah, he was having nothing of it. And so I had a choice when I graduated from college. I could either, you know what, sorry, Dad, I know you're dying. I'm going to go blaze my own trail. Or out of love and respect for you, I will go into business, even though it's not my passion. And that's exactly what I did. And I sort of joke, I did what every good son did. I waited till my father passed away, and then I followed my own dreams.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. So how did you start out in law enforcement? Like, is there an academy back then you went to for 6 months, a year? I'm not sure what the training was like, but.
Yeah. So my wife and I had gotten married. At the time, I was a hospital administrator, and we had moved to California for her job. And I saw an advertisement that came in the mail. We were living in Santa Barbara, at Santa Barbara City College, that said, if you took this class and you completed it, that you could apply to be a reserve police officer with any department in the state of California. And I thought, you know, you can imagine that conversation at dinner that night. You know, it was like, hey, hon, I've always been a suit and tie 8 to 5 kind of guy. I kind of like to explore this. What do you think? And my wife was incredibly supportive. I took the class. I got hired on with Santa Barbara PD. And so I was a customer service manager for an academic publishing company at the time. I would work my regular job all week, come home Friday after work, put on my uniform, go to roll call and work all night and come home Saturday morning. And my wife will tell you, she said, you know, you would come home exhausted, but you would have this big smile on your face. And so our daughter was born shortly after that. And we moved to Cincinnati, Ohio. And I said to my wife, look, I want to do this full time. I want to make a career out of it. And so I did. I went to the Cincinnati Police Academy. I was in the 84th recruit class. And, you know, again, kind of late in life, I was a 37-year-old rookie police officer, which by most accounts is pretty old to be getting into that line of work.
So you were a policeman for how long? Now, you kept in law enforcement, right, after that?
I did. I was in law enforcement for about 10 years until my wife lost her job in Cincinnati and we had to move to Texas. And so I kind of had to get out of it and do something else.
Did you do anything else like in law enforcement?
I started, when I was in law enforcement, yes, I was, and I know you're going to laugh at this because you're like, well, you're 6'8". How could you possibly have done this? I was an undercover narcotics investigator. I bought dope. I did all that kind of stuff. And I was also a SWAT team hostage negotiator. So
I have so many questions to ask you. I'm not going to lie. I'm a huge nerd when it comes to like audiobooks undercover. Like I listen to books about guys like you. DEA, FBI, going undercover, pretending to be the bad guy, let's say, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. I mean, we would buy drugs from people. You know, we would have marked money and we would, you know, buy from somebody. A lot of what we did was, our unit was called Street Corner. And so we did a lot of the street licks. We did, buying for the guy in the corner and then hopefully you can take it upstairs and, you know, get over him. And not eventually, but a lot of times we would work with the DEA because I'll give you an example why. So for me to charge you, say I bought drugs from you and you had a gun on you. Yep. One, I had to actually physically possess the gun. I had to have it. And two, the gun had a fire. It had to be operational. Mm-hmm. If the gun didn't work, I couldn't make a gun charge out of you. With the feds, with the DEA, say they were up on a search warrant, you know, on your cell phone or on your home phone at the time, and you mentioned the word gun. Uh-huh. That was a federal gun charge. They didn't have to have the gun. They never had to recover the gun. If you mentioned gun, say they were up on you 6 months on a federal wiretap, and you mentioned the word gun 30 times, you were going to have 30 federal gun charges in addition to whatever drug stuff they had. So we loved working with the feds because, like, you didn't even have to have the gun. They just had to mention it. You could charge them with it.
You know what's so funny, though? You watch movies and they make it kind of seem like the law enforcement hates the FBI, they hate the DA because they get in each other's turf.
Not really. I mean, let's face it. They were looking at big weight when it came to dope. We were looking at street level, you know, kind of stuff, you know, buying from somebody, getting out of the area and then having, you know, our teammates, so to speak, you know, sweep in and arrest the person because, you know, I mean, selling drugs is a felony. And so, you know, I mean, now what are you going to do? You're going to take me to court? I'm a cop. You're going to lose. I mean, we had the transaction, videotape sometimes, almost always audio tape. So we're going to go to court. We're going to present all this evidence. Here's the drugs. Here's the guy. We almost never went to trial on any of this just because our procedures were so good that we were like, you know what, you're going to lose. And so if you want to do it, you can. But most people never took us to trial.
Okay. So let's say if you're an officer, right, and you want to do undercover training, do they put you through like a 3-month drug dealer course or 6 months, or how do they train you in to pretend to be a drug dealer?
They take they take uniform officers. I was lucky in a lot of ways because my training officer had just come out of the drug unit and was back in uniform, so his specialty, so to speak, was drugs and guns. They kind of go together. So when I was riding with him, I got a lot of experience in how to sniff out drugs, what questions to ask, how to do that kind of line. It was sort of on the job training for me. And then when I was on my own, I spent a lot of time trying to get drugs and guns and things like that. So when the drug unit was looking for somebody, they look for people who are active in that kind of line of work. You know, were you a good drug cop? You know, do your cases hold up in court? You know, are you honest? Do you have integrity and that kind of stuff? And so I was actually later on as a uniform officer, I was paired with a partner, a friend of mine from my academy class, and she and I did a lot of drug work as well. So I went to the drug unit first, and then they were looking for a female to come down, and she came shortly after I did. So it just worked out really, really great because I started out with an officer who knew what he was doing to find drugs.
So you two actually worked together at the same time, or how'd that work?
I mean, we always went out as partners. I mean, we would buy drugs. That was one thing we did. We would investigate complaints. So a citizen would call in and say, hey, you know, my neighbor's selling drugs or something like that. So we would go And, you know, we'd be in an unmarked car and, you know, in civilian clothes, and we'd park down the street and watch the place for a while. Are we seeing a pattern of people pulling up, getting out for, you know, 30 seconds and then getting back in and leaving and stuff like that. And, you know, sometimes we would then try to pull over one of the people who we had observed go up to the house, be there for 30 seconds, come out. And then we'd have them pulled over by a uniform car. And then we'd do an investigation, you know, where were you coming from? How do you know that people? What's his name? That kind of stuff. And when people couldn't give you the right answer, you know, you'd kind of talk your way into the car. Hey, is there anything in your car? Oh, absolutely not. Do you mind if we search? No, go ahead. And, you know, we were pretty good at searching and we would find the drugs. And so now it's like, okay, do you want to work your case off or do you want to be a convicted felon? Because, you know, I mean, you're possessing crack cocaine. That's a felony. And a lot of times they would work their case off. So we would wire them up. We would give them the marked money. We would have them, you know, under our observation, go back into the place, buy drugs, and then come back and give it to us. And that they were informants, confidential informants. And then we would type up a search warrant for the house and have SWAT kick in the door. And then we would go in and search the house after everybody was secured.
I cannot imagine your adrenaline and how exciting that, I mean, you're doing it for a good cause, like no doubt, but did you get an excitement off of it or adrenaline rush or what was that like for you doing that? Like,
I mean, it was fun. I liked the hunt, to be honest with you. I mean, it wasn't so much getting the bad guy. Mm-hmm. I liked the hunt. I liked putting the case together. Mm-hmm. I liked, you know, doing that kind of stuff. But I mean, we were very highly scrutinized. I mean, you know, our search warrants had to be perfect. They were reviewed by, you know, a captain and above. I mean, I worked the night shift. So when we were doing a search warrant, a lot of times I'm waking a judge up at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, and going to their house and getting them to sign a warrant. And because of the reputation that our unit had, the judges were like, "You're with Street Corner? Oh, okay, I'll sign the warrant." I mean, we just had a very good reputation in what we did. So we were very meticulous on how we put a case together. And we would let somebody go because, you know, it's like, all right, we don't have it all together yet. All right, let's not do something stupid. Let's not put the cart before the horse. Let's wait. We'll get them, you know, a week from now or a month from now or something like that. And so we had all these kind of open cases and things like that. But there was really no... It was on the job training. You always worked with another person. And when you went to the unit, you worked with a more senior person. And then as you got more experience, you know, you would work with people that came to the unit later.
So have you ever had, let's say a criminal or bad guy say no to you, or was it 99% of the time? No, they worked with you because they don't want to do the time.
I mean, there were sometimes people would say, you know, we would go to buy drugs and people would say no, you know, but what motivated that industry, and it certainly is, you know, illicit drugs as an industry, was greed. And so if you had money, eventually you were going to find someone who would sell you drugs. And yes, there were times where, you know, people would, you know, no, get out of here. I got a bad feeling about you or something like that. Okay, that's fine. And, you know, and we'd go somewhere else. But I mean, I'll give you an example. My partner, who I told you, you know, came down to the unit after I did. She was working the day shift and I was working the night shift. And she called me up and she said, "Hey, I've got these kids, these young people coming down from Dayton, Ohio, and they want to sell you mushrooms. You know, will you buy?" And I'm like, "Yeah, sure. You know, what we've got to develop a cover. We've got to develop some kind of a story." And so I posed as a professor of metallurgy. I don't know anything about metallurgy other than, you know, you put metal out on the rain, it rusts. That was my extent of metallurgy. But I had a briefcase and all that kind of stuff. And I met these kids in a park. And, you know, the guy gets out, he jumps into my car, you know, I look at the mushrooms, I give him the $200. He gets back into his car and then he gets swarmed. You know, he had three or four other people in the car with him. The idea was they were going to get cash and then they were going to go bar hopping in Cincinnati. And instead of, you know, doing that, they were guests of the Hamilton County Justice Center that night and that kind of thing. So, I mean, you did stuff like that. You acted, but it was also incredibly dangerous. I mean, I didn't have anybody pull a gun on me, but I had, you know, my teammates who were, you know, they were buying drugs and stuff, you know, had guns pulled on them and stuff like that. So it's incredibly dangerous. And it's just, it's an ugly business. I mean, the things that addicts do to, you know, I don't have any money, but I need a fix. Well, they're selling their bodies. They're doing, I mean, they're just doing disgusting things to get a fix, which, you know, 3 hours from now, they're going to need another fix. So it's an ugly part of society that if you don't have to see it, it's not something I would recommend.
As an addiction counselor, I hear my clients tell stories of things that they've done to get that drug, the heroin, the meth. They don't care. They don't care about their life or anything. It's just they need that fix.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's not something, having never been addicted, you know, that's not something I can understand. And it's funny because I did a podcast with a couple of cadets at the Air Force Academy, mm-hmm. and they wanted to talk about this. And one of them asked me, you know, are there services out there to help people get off drugs? And I said, absolutely. There's all kinds of things that are available to people, even if they can't pay, where they can get help getting off drugs. But what I said to him was, that is only effective when the person hits, and you know this is an addiction company, when they hit rock bottom, when they get to the very, you know, very end of it. And I said, there's a very small line, a very fine line between rock bottom and dead. Yes. And as I'm sure people, you know, they go up in front of a judge and the judge says, you know, do you want help? And they're like, oh yeah, I want help. And you're like, yeah, they're just saying that so that, you know, they can go to treatment. And, they go to treatment and then they're back out on the streets doing the same thing. I mean, if you don't change the dynamic, if you don't change the environment, they go to treatment and you put them right back in the same area, living in the same place where they were living before, then what's changed? I mean, I'll never forget my very first run when I was a reserve officer in Santa Barbara. It was to a Burger King where a guy had just gotten out of prison. He'd been there like 18 months. He had, you know, X habit before he went in. And when he got out 18 months later, he went and bought X amount of heroin, injected it into his arm, and it killed him just like that. And he was dead on the toilet, you know, in the bathroom of a Burger King. But, you know, a useless, horrible thing to have happen. Because I'm sure he had a family somewhere that cared about him and loved him. But, you know, I mean, that was the very first run I ever had as a policeman.
And that's interesting because, like, my rock bottom might be different than your rock bottom. It Absolutely. May look different. And this might sound kind of callous for me from being a counselor, but have you ever heard of the term a PO is a trap, a probation officer?
No.
The theory is, like, if you're not willing to do the time or whatever, just go to jail. If you're going to treatment for the wrong reasons just to get out of jail, just do the time, because you're going to misbehave in treatment. You're going to end up relapsing in treatment, cause issues for possibly people who want to get better.
Right.
And you're going to end up right back in jail again. So it's like, do the year, do the 6 months of jail, and then you're out without a probation officer.
Right. Right. Exactly. And you know this, and that's the problem. It's a revolving door. You know, you arrest them, they go to treatment, they get out, they relapse, you rearrest them. It's just a revolving door. And as a policeman, you're like, are you really making a difference? You know, and I'm sure you feel the same way as a counselor. Yeah. You know, am I really making a difference here?
And it causes burnout in people, just like in the law enforcement field and just like the therapy field. It's burnout.
Yeah.
You know, and also you, again, stuck with law enforcement even further because you kind of shift gears a little bit, right?
I did. I got out of the drug unit and I went back to uniform patrol, became a sergeant. Mm-hmm. And then my wife lost her job. And so we moved to Texas and I'm like, well, let's see, you know, I've got an undergraduate degree, I got a master's degree, I got all this training in SWAT. Yeah. I've got, you know, so I'm like, well, what can I do? And I started, our daughter was in a private Catholic school. And I'm like, hey, how about if I do a security plan for you? And I said, I'll do it gratis. And they were like, yeah, sure. And they liked it. And then they started telling other people about it. And so I started a school security consulting business based on the training and the experience that I had in law enforcement.
Can you elaborate on that? So you're working with the school systems on security safety plans? Kind of like that, or is it?
Yeah, I was working more with, a lot of public schools have their own, you know, they have their own security officers. Yep. Some of them have their own police departments and things like that. I was working more with private independent schools around the country. So it was one location usually. And so it was everything from going in and doing an assessment, you know, I mean, do you leave your doors unlocked? Do you, I mean, I'll never forget. I did a school, I won't say where it was. It was like 4 o'clock in the afternoon and I walked into a classroom and there was nobody around, absolutely nobody. And it was a chemistry classroom and there were all kinds of chemicals available. Even the teacher's purse and all that were like, I mean, I could have cleaned up. I could have had, yeah. I mean, I could have stolen all this stuff. And you know, so it's things like that, that, you know, well, we live in a nice area and that's not, I'm like, yeah, until you don't live in a nice area and somebody realizes that, yeah. So I would do physical assessments of the grounds of the building. Mm-hmm. I would do policies and procedure development. You know, here are the things that you need to have in place and here's why. And then I would do training of the staff. So it was kind of a three-tiered approach depending on what they would want.
Like, let's say if a guy with a loaded gun goes into the school, you teach like strategy plans on how to, let's say, help with that situation.
Keep everybody safe, I mean, as much as you can, you know, and I mean, but you would tell them things like, you know, okay, here's what's going to happen. When this guy starts shooting, you know, law enforcement's going to arrive. And I told them what we did in Cincinnati, and I won't get into the specifics because I don't know if anybody listening to us will ever do that. But, you know, there's going to be a certain thing that's going to happen with the officers on scene. They're immediately going to do something to address the shooter. And I said, and what they're going to do is they're going to step over the wounded people, step over the dead people, and immediately address the person doing the shooting. So don't feel like, hey, you know, I got a bullet wound to the leg and you just walk by me. Yeah, we are. That's exactly what we're going to do. We're going to walk right by you because we got to address the shooter. So there aren't more people who have bullet legs to the, you know, or bullet wounds to their leg or even worse. Yeah. So don't feel that we're ignoring you. We just have to deal with the threat immediately and then we'll come back and deal with you.
It kind of reminds me of like when rescue teams or paramedics go into a site with a lot of, let's say, dead people or severely hurt people. They give them those tags, right, on priority on who to save and who not to even bother to save.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And that's, you know, I mean, if you got a chest wound and that, I'm sorry, we're walking right by you and we're going to find the shooter and deal with the shooter. So I know that sounds, you know, cold and callous. Mm-hmm. But bottom line is that's the training. That's the way it works. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're going to do.
Okay. So how long did you do that for then?
I did that for about 6 years. Okay. And then I developed cancer.
Okay. And if you don't mind, like, what was going through you, like when you first got diagnosed with cancer and everything? Was it more of a shock or could you explain?
Yeah, it was a huge shock. I mean, I was, you know, I had this school security consulting business and I was also a girls' high school basketball coach. Yeah. And so and that was the nice thing about being my, you know, your own boss. You could kind of, you know, move the business down during basketball season and then kind of ramp it up in the off season. And so I was a basketball coach and I had a callus break open on the bottom of my foot, right below my third toe. And initially didn't think much of it because as a coach, you're on your feet a lot. Yeah. But after it didn't heal for a while, I went and made an appointment with a podiatrist friend of mine, a foot doctor, and he took an x-ray and he's like, Terry, I think you have a little cyst in there and I can cut it out. And he did. And he showed it to me. It was just a little gelatin sack with some white fat in it. No dark spots, no blood, nothing that gave either one of us concern.
Yeah.
But fortunately or unfortunately, he sent it off to pathology, you know, to have it examined. And then 2 weeks later, I received a call from him. And as I said, he was a friend of mine. And the more difficulty he was having explaining what was going on, the more frightened I was becoming until finally he just laid it out for me. He said, Terry, I've been a doctor for 25 years. I have never seen the form of cancer that you have. You have an incredibly rare form of melanoma that appears on the bottom of the feet or the palms of the hands. And because your cancer is so rare, he recommended that I go to MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston and be treated. And so I did, you know, I had the tumor excised, removed on the bottom of my foot. I had all the lymph nodes in my groin removed. I had a skin graft over the wound on my foot where the cancer had been cut out. Mm-hmm. And then my oncologist put me on a weekly injection of a drug called interferon to help keep the disease from coming back. And interferon for me was a horrible, nasty, debilitating drug. Yeah. The side effects of the interferon were that it gave me severe flu-like symptoms for 2 to 3 days every week after each injection. Yeah. And I took those weekly injections for almost 5 years. So imagine having the flu every week for 5 years. And that wasn't a cure. That was just, right. You know, as my oncologist used to say, we're kicking the can down the road. We're trying to buy you more time. 2017, I ended up in the intensive care unit with a fever of 108 degrees because of the toxicity of the interferon. So I had to stop it. And as soon as I stopped it, the cancer came back in the exact same spot on my foot, which necessitated my left foot being amputated in 2018. Yep. 2019, the cancer worked its way up my leg into my shin, requiring 2 more surgeries. And then in 2020, an undiagnosed tumor kind of in my ankle area grew large enough that it fractured my tibia, my shin bone. And my only recourse right in the middle of the pandemic was to have my left leg amputated. And I also found out I had tumors in my lungs, which I'm still being treated for.
Okay. No, that's horrible. I can't relate, but my father has cancer. And a lot of like the symptoms you kind of mentioned seemed like what he would go through with his chemo, with the flu-like symptoms and everything and how it drag on. And so I guess I can relate more to your daughter with that experience with watching your father go through this. And what was it like to support, like going through it? Like how much was that a huge part of your recovery when it came to this? And
yeah, it is. And I talk about what I call my three F's that have gotten me through cancer, which are faith, family, and friends. Mm-hmm. I have a very strong faith in God. It's funny, and maybe you've experienced this, you know, people start down a road toward a goal or something like that, you know, and then they butt up against an impediment, something stops them, and then they quit. But we don't just quit. We got to blame somebody. We got to find somebody to blame. And, you know, so people want to blame their, you know, their parents or their teachers or their boss, whatever it is. And when I got cancer, people were like, well, who do you blame? Like, what do you mean? Mm. Who do I blame? I don't blame anybody from, you know, because I got cancer. And then they find out I have a faith and they're like, well, you must blame God. And I'm like, no, I mean, I sort of joke. I don't think God got up on a Tuesday morning and checked his to-do list and said, you know, Terry Tucker, cancer today. Yeah. I don't think that at all, but I do think God has given me the strength. And then my family, it's just my wife and daughter and I. And when I had my leg amputated, my doctor wanted to put me on chemotherapy. And I was 8 years into this fight and I looked at him and I'm like, is it going to save my life? He was kind of like, probably not, but it might buy you some more time. And I'm like, well, I don't know if I want to do that, you know, go down that road if the outcome is going to be the same, but I'll go home and talk to my family.
Yeah.
And so I go home and I start telling my wife and daughter about it. And my daughter's immediately, all right, we need a family meeting. I'm like, family meeting? There's three of us. It's not like we got a board or something like that, you know? So I'm like, okay. So we all sat around the kitchen table and individually talked about how we felt about me having chemo. Mm-hmm. And then my daughter's like, all right, let's take a vote. How many people want dad to have chemotherapy? And my wife and daughter raised their hand. And I'm like, wait a minute. Oh. Am I getting outvoted for something that I don't want to do? But I remembered back when I was in the police academy and our defensive tactics instructor used to have us bring a photograph of the people we love the most to class. And as we were learning to defend ourselves, we were to look at that photograph because he reasoned you'll fight harder for the people you love than you'll fight for yourself. So I took chemotherapy, not because I wanted to, but because I love my family more than I love myself. And then the last part of this is friends. And I think when you get a chronic or a terminal illness, you certainly find out, you know, who's going to be in the corner with you, who's going to be in the foxhole with you. And, you know, there were people I expected to be there that aren't. And there are people that I never thought that would be there that are today. So it all works out in the end.
That's a special thing. Yeah. Cause again, you really, I'm not saying that they weren't good friends, but you find out who your true friends are in a sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I want to also ask you too, did you ever take any of the skills that you learned from your police training when it came to your recovery from cancer, any type of motivational trainings from law enforcement that, again, you used to help you overcome this obstacle?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't know if they were necessarily specific to law enforcement, but certainly, you know, one of the things that I talk about is right now I'm on a clinical trial drug that most likely isn't going to save my life, but very well may save the life of somebody, you know, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, based on the data that the doctors are gleaning from my blood tests and my scans and things like that. And I think one of the things I learned early in life is that, you know, I started playing basketball when I was 9 and I played all the way up till I was 21. And I think you realize as part of a team, being part of team sports, the importance of being part of something that's bigger than you. And, you know, you realize that on a team, if you don't do your job, not only do you let yourself down, but you let your teammates down, your coaches down, your fans down, et cetera. And if you think about it, the biggest team game that we all play is this game of life. So while, you know, this drug may not help me in the long run, it may help somebody else. And to me, that's part of being part of something that's bigger than yourself. And I had a nurse ask me recently, she said, you know, what was it like to have your foot amputated and then have your leg amputated? And I told her, I said, it's not been easy. You know, it's been 2 years since the amputation. I'm still learning to walk with a prosthetic leg. But what I told her is that, you know, cancer can take all my physical faculties, but cancer can't touch my mind. It can't touch my heart and it can't touch my soul. And that's who I am. You know, that's who you are, Jacob. That's who our, you know, your listeners are. This is just a vessel or a body or, you know, or a home or whatever you want to say to house who we really are. So I don't get all, I mean, I am scarred, you know, from like the waist down, I'm scarred all over the place, but I've earned those scars.
Yep.
And so while they don't look pretty, I'm proud of them. You know, I'm proud of what I've gotten through, you know, to get to this point where I'm still here, where nobody expected me to make it after 5 years. So, you know, I mean, now I'm working on year 11, you know, I don't spend a lot of time worrying when doctors like, you know, you only have this much time. Doctors don't know your mind. Right. Doctors don't know your heart. Doctors don't know your soul. They don't know your daughter's getting married in 2 years. And by God, you're going to be there for it. So I don't spend a lot of time, especially I encourage people, don't take what a doctor says as gospel. They don't know you. And your resolve is a big part of whether you survive or how long you survive.
And you've proven right there, like you had the power to choose your way of life, the way of living, where if somebody had the opposite mindset, let's say they did go with a blaming routine, which, I mean, I'm not perfect. I've blamed before. It's just it's so easy. And maybe in a sick way, it kind of feels good to blame someone else. But I think if that person would have done that, they wouldn't be where you are today.
Yeah, I don't blame anybody. I made a decision very early on in my cancer journey that I'm not going to take, you know, me having a bad day, me feeling sick to my stomach, me not feeling good at all. I'm not going to take that on a doctor or a nurse or a therapist or somebody who's trying to help me. That just, you know, I saw a lot of people, have seen a lot of people that have done that. You know, they're mad, they're having a bad day, and they take it out on everybody who's around them. And it's like, why are you doing that? These people are here to help you feel better and get better. And you're just making their life miserable. I made a decision early on that I would never do that. Now, have I fallen from time to time? Yeah, I probably have, you know, where I really didn't feel good but I really try to keep that top of mind so that I don't take it out on somebody because I know they're trying to help me.
Amen. Well, no, you truly have an awesome story. And I would love for you to talk a little bit about your book, if you don't mind, and really what gave you the motivation for that book.
Yeah. You know, there's sort of that old joke that goes, you know, when we talk to God, it's called prayer. Mm-hmm. When God talks to us, it's called schizophrenia. So I'm not going to say that, you know, that God ever talked to me. But I do think what God does is he puts people in our path that makes suggestions. Hey, you ought to write a book. Hey, you ought to start a blog. Mm-hmm. Hey, you ought to be a motivational speaker. And when enough of those people, you know, start making that suggestion, I think I'm smart enough to kind of buck up and be like, oh, maybe I ought to pay attention to what was going on. So people started to suggest you should write a book. And I'm like, write a book? I'm not an author. I'm not, you know, I mean, are you kidding me? But enough people started to suggest it. And so the book was really born out of two conversations I had. One was with a former basketball player who had moved to the area where my wife and I would live with her fiance. And we'd had dinner one night. And I remember after dinner, I said to her, you know, I'm really excited that you're living close and I can watch you find and live your purpose. Mm-hmm. And she got real quiet for a while. And then she kind of looked at me and she's like, well, coach, what do you think my purpose is? I said, I have no idea what your purpose is, but that's what your life should be about, finding the reason you were put on the face of this earth and then living that reason. So that was one conversation. And then I had a young man reach out to me on social media and ask me what I thought were the most important things he should learn to not just be successful in his job or in business, but to be successful in life. And I didn't want to give him the, you know, get up early, work hard, help others. Not that those aren't important. They are incredibly important. But I wanted to see if maybe I could go deeper with them. So I spent some time and I started writing notes. And eventually I had these, you know, these 10 ideas, these 10 thoughts, these 10 principles. And so I sent them to him. And then when I had my leg amputated, I had a 3-month period where I was healing from that amputation before I started chemo. And I remember I would sit down every day at the computer and I would build stories underneath each of those principles. And they're real stories about real people, you know, real events that occurred. And that's how my book, Sustainable Excellence, The 10 Principles to Leading Your Uncommon and Extraordinary Life, came about.
And I just want to let all my listeners know, I will have the link for that book in the show notes. So if you want to purchase it, just click away. Well, Terry, I just have to say it's been an incredible honor and pleasure having you on my podcast. It truly has.
Well, Jacob, I really appreciate it. I mean, I always say it's nice people like you that allow me, you know, to come on and tell my story. And hopefully between our conversation, we're going to make a difference in the life of some of your audience members. And if we do that, to me, today's been a good day.
Amen. I really hope we do. And another thing too, if my listeners do want to get a hold of you for motivational interviewing or speaking, is there a phone number and email they could use to make contact with you?
Yeah, the best way to get a hold of me, I have a blog. I put up a thought for the day on my blog every day. And with that thought usually comes a question about maybe how you could apply that thought in your life. On Mondays, I put up the Monday morning motivational message, which is usually a video I found or a story. It's maybe a little bit longer. I also have recommendations for books, videos, some of the podcasts I've been on are on there, but you can also leave me a message, you know, and reach out to me if you want me to come and speak to your organization, or you just want to ask me a question. And I answer everybody who does that. And the blog is called Motivational Check. And the way you can get to me is motivationalcheck.com.
Okay, good. And I'll make sure I put that in my show notes as well.
Thank you.
Well, again, Terry, it was awesome. Thank you so much for being here. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
I just want to inform everyone that the content expressed in this episode was not meant to be taken as therapeutic advice. If you do find yourself struggling with any type of mental health or addiction issue, please seek the care of a licensed mental health professional or a licensed medical doctor. All right. Thank you and have a good day. Bye.